So, we continue this evening in Chapter 11, The Delight of Existence, The Problem. So, Sri Aurobindo has led us through a luminous web of reasoning, which arrives at this notion that there is an absoluteness of being which is fully conscious, fully regnant, powerful in its own nature. And that nature is of delight. And that because it cannot be limited, because it is in its deep character to be unwalled, then how does it move into existence? Why does it move into existence? Some constriction of its conscious force is necessary. Some aim must be there. And to Sri Aurobindo, the only answer there can be to this question is that this Supreme Being must move for the purpose of delight. It can only be to experience itself in limited form that it would leave its infinity for that. It cannot be compelled from within itself. There's no part of its own being that can force it to happen. It must be the law of its own self-expression that leads to this vast manifestation of a universe, to the particularity of individuals within the universe. So that if pain and evil arise, we have to see why that would be possible. Could it be imposed from outside upon universal being by a divinity which lives outside the cosmos? To Sri Aurobindo, this is a ridiculous proposition because there is only one without a second. So the very nature of existence is to be an expression of the one being. There is no second. There can be no God outside. So whatever is occurring, whether these be waves of pleasure or incidents of pain, must all occur within the actual, real being of the divine. It is the divine who experiences this fundamentally. It is not imposed outside of his nature on someone else, nor does it happen accidentally. Ah, so then we have to see what it means that this one existence without a second could allow self-suffering to occur. And to gather that, we have to look at the wider context. So we begin tonight with the paragraph, "We have to recognize." It's roughly midway through the chapter. "We have to recognize, if we thus view the whole, not limiting ourselves to the human difficulty and the human standpoint, that we do not live in an ethical world." Let's pause for a moment. We've seen terms throughout this chapter referring to ethics and morality, and let's just define ethics for a moment. It comes from the Greek, ethikos, which means really custom. So it is a way of being which, in philosophic context, wants to distinguish between what is good and right and what is evil and wrong. So ethical systems arise in human life. But the world, he wants to suggest, is not ethical. This is a human difficulty, so let's pursue that. The attempt of human thought to force an ethical meaning into the whole of nature is one of those acts of willful and obstinate self-confusion, one of those pathetic attempts of the human being to read himself, his limited habitual human self, into all things and judge them from the standpoint he has personally evolved, which most effectively prevent him from arriving at real knowledge and complete sight. Our interpretation of the world is in figures of ourself. We project our own nature upon the world, or let us say, the best of our nature upon the world, and ask why it doesn't behave according to that best of all human concepts. Sri Aurobindo continues, material nature is not ethical. The law which governs it is a coordination of fixed habits which take no cognizance of good and evil, but only of force that creates, force that arranges and preserves, force that disturbs and destroys impartially, non-ethically, according to the secret will in it, according to the mute satisfaction of that will in its own self-formations and self-dissolutions. So he's talking strictly here now of the physical part of the cosmos. He implies that there is a secret will operative in it, but as this force arranges, sustains, and destroys physical objects, it doesn't do any of it with an ethical sense. It isn't that one thing is right, and so it sustains, and another thing is wrong, and so it is destroyed. All things are created, and all things are destroyed in the physical world. Transience is its very nature. The stuff of the universe is in constant flux. So there is a raw, routinized force operating at the material level. He goes on, animal or vital nature is also non-ethical, although as it progresses, it manifests the crude material out of which the higher animal evolves the ethical impulse. So eventually, as the animal forms develop, we will arrive at fellow feeling, we will arrive at self-restraint, and that is the commencement of ethical behavior. But it is by no means the law of life. He continues to illustrate, we do not blame the tiger because it slays and devours its prey, any more than we blame the storm because it destroys, or the fire because it tortures and kills. Neither does the conscious force in the storm, the fire, or the tiger blame or condemn itself. Blame and condemnation, or rather, self-blame and self-condemnation, are the beginning of true ethics. When we blame others without applying the same law to ourselves, we are not speaking with the true ethical judgment, but only applying the language ethics has evolved for us to an emotional impulse of recoil from or dislike of that which displeases or hurts us. So, if this were a true ethics, it would be impartial in its meting out of justice here and there. But this idea is one that, simply put, is hooray for me and boo for you. And that is not an ethical stance. A wiser standpoint would perceive the conscious force operating in all, but he's driving us into that. We'll get there. This recoil or dislike, he writes, is the primary origin of ethics. Well, that means that there is a negativing force which is aiming at restraint. In other words, to bridle our impulses, to put the reins on the impulses and pull back. That's the beginning of ethics, to withhold an action. So it begins in a negativing way. Ethics requires us to consider the other person. We don't want to do this action because the consequences will be untoward for that person, possibly for me. So, this recoil or dislike is the primary origin of ethics, but is not itself ethical. The fear of the deer for the tiger, the rage of the strong creature against its assailant, is a vital recoil of the individual delight of existence from that which threatens it. So he's looking at the structure behind the behavior. What is the root motif active here? In the progress of the mentality, it refines itself into repugnance, dislike, disapproval. Disapproval of that which threatens and hurts us, approval of that which flatters and satisfies, refine into the conception of good and evil to oneself, to the community, to others than ourselves, to other communities than ours, and finally into the general approval of good, the general disapproval of evil. So we see that the context widens. This idea of what is good and evil is applied to larger and larger collectivities. No longer does it have force only upon the individual, but the tribe, the society, the nation, the world should behave according to what becomes an agreed upon set of principles. But throughout, the fundamental nature of the thing remains the same. Man desires self-expression, self-development. In other words, the progressing play in himself of the conscious force of existence. That is his fundamental delight. So, this existence in us, which is real, is looking to express itself, wishes to forge forwards and seek the expansion of its own being, seek the taste of what is out there. And that is the fundamental motivation of delight in us. So whatever hurts that self-expression, he says, self-development, satisfaction of his progressing self, is for him evil. Whatever helps, confirms, raises, aggrandizes, ennobles it, is his good. What contradicts our motivation is bad. What confirms it is good. Only his conception of the self-development changes, becomes higher and wider, begins to exceed his limited personality, to embrace others, to embrace all in its scope. So we're moving from the little to the large. We're moving from a limited good to a wider good, from our personal welfare to the general welfare, embracing the world. So our sense of self also expands from this restricted beginning sense of our individuality to something that becomes universal. Obviously, he will expound upon that shortly. But where have we left with reference to this? He says, in other words, ethics is a stage in evolution. That which is common to all stages is the urge of satchit ananda towards self-expression, What is Satchit-Ananda? Sat, existence. Chit, consciousness. Ananda, delight. Satchit-Ananda is the basis of all existence, and it is not absent here. It is invested fully in this world, in ourselves. So what's common to all the stages of development, of which ethics is a stage, is this self-expression, this urge to manifest delight. So we have to see it from the beginnings of the cosmos to where we are. He says, this urge is at first non-ethical, then infra-ethical in the animal, then in the intelligent animal, even anti-ethical, for it permits us to approve hurt done to others, which we disapprove when done to ourselves. Whoops, there's that hooray again. So evolution is something that he sees based in matter, which hides the conscious existence, and then develops into plant and animal forms and rises to the ethical level when we arrive at the human being. So human society, based upon the mind, upon this initial self-affirming consciousness, is appropriately ethical, or at least should have an ethical aim. That's part of its evolutionary status. But he writes, in this respect, man even now is only half ethical. We have not fully acquired that status. And just as all below us is infra-ethical, so there may be that above us, whither we shall eventually arrive, which is supra-ethical, has no need of ethics, so it is above the ethical norm. The normative values of the mind may no longer apply to us when we exceed and outgrow them. Consciousness extends beyond the limitation of the mind, just as it extends beyond the limitation of consciousness embedded in matter and slowly, partially emergent in life. It continues its upward arc. So he suggests here that instead of having to arrive at a system of ethics, the supra-ethical is a state in which there is a spontaneous harmony. And we'll get to that in just a moment at the bottom of the paragraph. The ethical impulse and attitude, so all important to humanity, is a means by which it struggles out of the lower harmony and universality, based upon inconscience and broken up by life into individual discords, towards a higher harmony and universality based upon conscient oneness with all existences. With all existences. So again, the secret of being is oneness. There is one without a second, which is the basis of all being. We call that, figuratively, Satchit-Ananda. That's the only way we can describe it. But all existences are manifestations of that, and we will arrive at the highest harmony when we live in a conscious oneness with it all. Huh. That doesn't mean we can't take an action this way or that way for fear of harming or out of desire for helping another. But it means that based upon that consciousness of oneness, we are led to act. Arriving at that goal, this means will no longer be necessary or even possible, since the qualities and oppositions on which it depends will naturally dissolve and disappear in the final reconciliation. So the quality of life or the standard of judgment disappears with the arrival at this experience of dominant oneness everywhere. So we have to continue, right? If then, the ethical standpoint applies only to a temporary, though all-important passage from one universality to another, we cannot apply it to the total solution of the problem of the universe, but can only admit it as one element in that solution. To do otherwise is to run into the peril of falsifying all the facts of the universe, all the meaning of the evolution behind and beyond us, in order to suit a temporary outlook and a half-evolved view of the utility of things. So we can't regard the universe from our small current vision. That perspective is too limited. It's in the process of development. And it would be unjust to apply it to the warp and the woof of all the cosmos. It has application, perhaps, to us in our current stage of development, and it may have no application anywhere else. The world has three layers: infra-ethical, ethical, and supra-ethical. So that which is below morality, that which we can judge according to moral standards, our life, and that which is supra-ethical, above morality. We have to find that which is common to all, for only so can we resolve the problem. So there's a universal, or even a wider context, that implies cosmic being, or implies a reality that assumes cosmic being. And if we don't get to that universal standpoint, we can't really see the problem. We can't really understand it. So it would convict the individual of too facile, too limited a perspective to be able to judge all of creation through the means, through the lens of that morality, which is our creation. So he continues, that which is common to all is, as we have seen, I'll start again. That which is common to all is, we have seen, the satisfaction of conscious force of existence, developing itself into forms and seeking in that development its delight. So, the conscious force, the chit shakti, is seeking delight in the various forms of its self-expression. From that satisfaction or delight of existence, he writes, it evidently began, for it is that which is normal to it, to which it clings, which it makes its base. But it seeks new forms of itself, and in the passage to higher forms, there intervenes the phenomenon of pain and suffering, which seems to contradict the fundamental nature of its being. This, and this alone, is the root problem. So in this graded universe, evolving from a material base through the vital into the mental and pointing beyond, there comes this phenomenon of pain, its interpretation as suffering, and now we have to answer why it's there. And so the rest of the paragraph really states the nature of the core problem. How shall we solve it? Shall we say that Satchit Ananda is not the beginning and end of things, but the beginning and end is nihil, an impartial void, itself nothing, but containing all potentialities of existence or non-existence, consciousness or non-consciousness, delight or undelight. So we seem, with this paragraph, to have gone back to the beginning of the book, or at least several chapters back, regarding how does it all begin? Are we going to say that it comes from nothing? We've arrived at the thesis, positively viewed, that it is Satchit-Ananda, which is the basis of all things. That what we would call non-being is the transcendence of positive being into the freedom of its own illimitability, and can remain unmanifest, can remain undefined even by Sat in its absolute unknowableness. That, Sri Aurobindo says, we can accept as an equivalent to non-being. But a true nihil, he brings us back to this, a nihil means a nothingness. But how could this nothingness contain all potentialities of existence? Because clearly we have a universe in front of us. We know ourselves. So how did it get here from what was absolutely nothing? How could it contain all of this? So he says, we may accept this answer if we choose, implying thereby that we shouldn't. But although we seek thereby to explain everything, we have really explained nothing. We have only included everything. A nothing which is full of all potentialities is the most complete opposition of terms and things possible. And we have therefore only explained a minor contradiction by a major, by driving the self-contradiction of things to their maximum. Nihil is the void, where there can be no potentialities. An impartial indeterminate of all potentialities is chaos. And all that we have done is to put chaos into the void without explaining how it got there. So this is not altogether nonsense. Chaos would refer to an indeterminacy of being, where potentialities may be here, may be there, but they're pell-mell. There is no order. There's no reason why any of that in a chaotic condition would rise into being. An ancient Greek mythology has to explain how something can come out of chaos, how cosmos can come out of chaos. But chaos is still better than a nihil, because at least there are potentialities there. What we've posited, if we say we're going back to the nihil, is that there's a nothingness which somehow contains potentialities, and then they leap into manifestation somehow. That's nonsense. That's not a philosophy. Not a philosophy that makes any sense. So he concludes this paragraph by saying, let us return then to our original conception of Satchit-Ananda and see whether on that foundation a completer solution is not possible. So he accepts the appearance of pain. He is now looking for its root, and he's going back in terms of metaphysics which unite with cosmogony and eventuate in cosmology. So in other words, there is a core being which begins and initiates a cosmos for purposes of delight, and thus the universe develops and develops upwards, and along that upward development in the manifestation of life and mind meets pain, which, as all things begin, is a limitation of being. From the illimitable, from the infinite, to the limited and the finite. And thus, as we move upwards in our search for self-expressive delight, we encounter pain because we are limited. So, he continues with the next paragraph. We must first make it clear to ourselves that just as when we speak of universal consciousness, we mean something different from, more essential and wider than the waking mental consciousness of the human being, so also when we speak of universal delight of existence, we mean something different from, more essential and wider than the ordinary emotional and sensational pleasure of the individual human creature. So we're going to scale upwards here. To understand the nature of the problem, we have to get out of limited being and see things from the widest possible perspective, something that regards the entire cosmos at once. So he's implying that the solution to this problem is to regard it from a universal proportion and perspective. Pleasure, joy, and delight, as man uses the words, are limited and occasional movements which depend on certain habitual causes and emerge like their opposites, pain and grief, which are equally limited and occasional movements, from a background other than themselves. Delight of being is universal, illimitable, and self-existent, not dependent on particular causes, the background of all backgrounds from which pleasure, pain, and other more neutral experiences emerge. So we can hardly compare the two. What we experience commonly can't be compared to the delight which is at the basis of the world. That is categorically different, fundamentally different. For one thing, it's universal. For another thing, essentially, it is without measure. It's not limited only to the universe. It resiles back into its own essence of being. When delight of being seeks to realize itself as delight of becoming, when this Satchit-Ananda wants to move, in other words, it moves in the movement of force, and itself takes different forms of movement of which pleasure and pain are positive and negative currents. Note, the one becomes multiple. Being moves into becoming, and as it moves into becoming, it establishes these channels, this polarity, positive and negative, pleasure and pain, which are the modes by which it defines itself in manifestation. Subconscient in matter, superconscient beyond mind, this delight seeks in mind and life to realize itself by emergence in the becoming, in the increasing self-consciousness of the movement. So he's ascribing a basis of things, which is below consciousness, literally subconscient. He's saying there is a ceiling, you might say. We'll find it malleable. A superconscient, that which is beyond our consciousness. And beyond and below have between these two intermediary terms, life and mind. And they seek to realize, according to their terms of being, what is emergent in the pursuit of universal delight. So, its first phenomena, he writes, are dual and impure, move between the poles of pleasure and pain, but it aims at its self-revelation in the purity of a supreme delight of being, which is self-existent and independent of objects and causes. So delight seeks to emerge in phenomena which are dual and limited, but it moves it goes towards a delight which is independent and the essence of its own being. That is the emergent ultimate stage. Just as Satchidananda moves towards the realization of the universal existence in the individual and of the form exceeding consciousness in the form of body and mind, so it moves towards the realization of universal, self-existent, and objectless delight in the flux of particular experiences and objects. This is a wonderful sentence, establishing that universal delight must be founded in individual existence. If we, stationed in our assigned individuality, are to fulfill the cosmic goal, then we must become aware of the universal in our own being. The microcosm must begin to reflect the macrocosm, must live in conscious communion with it, and even so, come to know that which is beyond even universal existence. We exceed also the form of our individuality in so realizing that. So it may be a finite form, but it defines the cosmic and captures, in essence, the truth of the transcendent. Just so, our particular experiences of pleasure and however else you may describe the grades of our exploration of the universe must eventuate similarly in a universal delight, which again places itself in the lap of its own delight of being, its own creative urge as an all-originating ananda. So, those objects we now seek as stimulating causes of a transient pleasure and satisfaction. Free, possessed of self, we shall not seek, but shall possess them as reflectors rather than causes of a delight which eternally exists. So, right now, we go out looking for these objects, thinking to experience and possess them, thinking that they cause this delight in us. They do not. Inwardly, we possess them and shall possess them when we have recovered our self, capital S, which possesses all objects as expressions or reflectors of that eternal ananda, that eternal delight. Because all these things speak of that delight. And how can we really embrace them? How can we really have them? Well, we can't have them from the impermanence, from the limited form, reaching to get that. We can only do that by the embrace of consciousness with consciousness, force with force, ananda with ananda, being with being. So it's in finding that self whose nature is Satchit Ananda in us that we can experience the delight in all things and exceed all the qualia from pleasure to pain. All then speaks to us of that ananda, whatever be the nature of the experience, sharp, dull, sweet, bitter, all is ananda. So now, so we get this, right? This implies that the individual can live universally in a transcendent delight and experience all existence as waves of a creative and cosmic being figuring that delight. In the egoistic human being, the mental person, emergent out of the dim shell of matter. Delight of existence is neutral, semi-latent, still in the shadow of the subconscious, hardly more than a concealed soil of plenty covered by desire, with a luxuriant growth of poisonous weeds and hardly less poisonous flowers, the pains and pleasures of our egoistic existence. When the divine conscious force, working secretly in us, has devoured these growths of desire, when, in the image of the Rig Veda, the fire of God has burnt up the shoots of earth, that which is concealed at the roots of these pains and pleasures, their cause and secret being, the sap of delight in them, will emerge in new forms not of desire, but of self-existent satisfaction, which will replace mortal pleasure by the immortal's ecstasy. And this transformation is possible because these growths of sensation and emotion are in their essential being, the pains no less than the pleasures, that delight of existence which they seek but fail to reveal. Fail because of division, ignorance of self, and egoism. So, when Agni, that divine fire which resides in our inmost recesses, which is the core of our flaming souls, burns up the dross of egoism, we will find that self-existent ananda behind all things. You may remember that there was a citation, a motto that Sri Aurobindo referred to at the beginning of the first chapter of The Life Divine. I'll quote only a part of it. That which is immortal in mortals and possessed of the truth is a god and established inwardly as an energy working out in our divine powers. Vamadeva is the author of that. Rig Veda 4, 2, 1. So that conscious energy is the very power of God moving forth, burning up the experiences of the world as an offering, as an exploration, as a purification, as a revelation. What it reveals ultimately is that self, supreme, always delighted, stationed everywhere, and your own nature. So he has now set the problem. This defines the problem. Next week, we take up the 12th chapter, Delight of Existence, the Solution. 12 being a number of fulfillment. Nice. So, a brief question before we go for our meditation, or you feel drawn inwards already? Very good. Then, Jai Ma, Namaste.